You're listening to Mike and Kristen,
the podcast.
I'm Mike, a musician, writer, and producer.
And I'm Kristen, a painter, writer, and designer.
Our show is all about following dreams, taking chances, and what life as an artist is really about.
Together, we bring you weekly guest interviews and thought-provoking conversations.
Let's go! What is going on, Kristen? How are you today?
I'm excited today. I've got my carry-on suitcase packed and our plane tickets booked, and we are heading to the sunny south for a couple more podcast conferences. Let's go.
South by Southwest, 100,000 people converge onto Austin, Texas for music, for film, for everything you can imagine. There's conferences on, and just this gathering of so many minds and people who are, yeah, all into learning and experiencing life.
It feels as though this could be a life-changing opportunity. I want to go in with an open mind and no expectations, but simply reading what this conference has to offer, it feels impossible not to come out with some monumental learning.
Yeah, we'll take away a lot, and we'll tell everybody about it when we get back.
And Texas barbecue. I know that's what you're really going for.
Yeah, we'll go to at least one, maybe five, but we'll see.
And bats. We hear that there's a big bat sighting happening in Austin, so they get everything.
Yeah, maybe we can barbecue some bats.
Barbecue and bats, yeah.
Same time.
We'll get one of those spits that you churn them. That's the right word. Like a pig roast. Yeah. So that's happening.
Yeah. Austin, Texas, South by Southwest. We're taking in as much knowledge as we possibly can. And we have a guest on this week who has a lot of knowledge and a lot of amazing stories and an amazing career. Mr. Jonathan Torrance.
How surreal was it to be sitting across from someone we idolized, essentially, as teenagers in his home, reflecting on all of his achievements and who he's grown to be as a person? It just felt like such a special moment in history for us in our lives.
He has such a wide and vast and impressive career that... Yeah. We didn't even really specifically touch on all these aspects. Like, oh, you played J-Rock and Trailer Park Boys. You were on this and this and this. It was just, we just got to know him and really celebrate the person that he is, which is just a really nice guy.
When someone has a resume like Jonathan Torrance, it's impossible to go through that in any kind of robust way without that being the whole interview.
Yeah.
We could have spent an hour and a half just talking about Street Sense.
Yeah. Street Sense was a big one. Like, I've never met someone from Canada who didn't watch Street Sense in that time period.
And everything since then. And he's still creating these brilliant pieces of work. I mean, it hasn't stopped. He talked about starting Street Sense at the age of 15 years old.
Yeah.
And it's been nothing but hits ever since then. And we know of Jonathan. We didn't get the chance to talk about this so much in the interview, but everyone that we have talked to that knows him mentions that he prioritizes people. It's really important to him that people are paid well on set and really seen and celebrated. And I think it really, now having gotten to know him better, you can see how that would be the case. He's just a genuinely kind person.
And he's a family man. Like, his best friends are his family, and he's a great dad, and he has animals that we got to see and meet. And
he has a slide in his house right beside his staircase, so you can choose one of two travel methods.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the biggest thing that came out of this for me was just he's just a genuinely great dude and so successful, but at the same time, he's just a guy living in rural Nova Scotia with a lot of stories and an amazing history behind him.
We often talk about time being the most precious resource, and for someone who I imagine has very little time available on his hands for him to allow us to come into his home and occupy so much of his day. I think that alone speaks to what a giving person he is.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And we got another quote for Thoughts and Things this week.
Oh, exciting. You picked this one.
Yeah. Here's the song.
Thoughts and things, thoughts and things, thoughts and things, thoughts and things.
Everything you've ever wanted is sitting on the other side of fear. George Adair.
Good one, George.
Yeah.
This is a really, this is a broad quote. I feel like this will sit with people differently depending on their background or their headspace right now hearing this. I heard somebody recently talk about how jealousy is really just another form of fear. And it got me thinking about how many emotions do we feel that really take us back to fear? And that's kind of the root cause of all this, this bigger spectrum.
But if you can overcome that, everything you've ever wanted,
yeah,
right there.
Yeah. Do you believe it? Do you believe that, that it's that simple as that statement?
I think so. I think it's a hard thing, though, to accomplish, because there's always little things you might fear, whether your kid's going to get the flu or something, like even like small things like that. I think it's impossible to just eliminate fear. But I think in terms of like tasks or goals, things you're trying to accomplish in that sense, like I want to be successful or get this career path. I think if you eliminate the things that may be holding you back, which are likely some form of fear, I think in that sense, I think you can accomplish anything you want for sure.
I like the holding you back way of thinking about this. Because maybe you are, okay, I'm afraid of being out in the middle of the ocean without, well, just period. That's the end of the sentence. But it's also not a fear that holds me back from living my life in any meaningful way. So some types of fear maybe aren't problematic.
Yeah, you don't have to overcome every fear.
Right. Like, it's okay to be afraid of some things.
Like, if you're afraid of lions and you live in Nova Scotia, it's all good.
That's probably okay. Yeah. It's not a barrier.
Just don't go to the zoo. The zoo's closing, though. Yeah. Oak Lawn Farms.
We should have asked Jonathan what he was afraid of.
I think nothing.
Yeah. He's pretty invincible, isn't he?
Yeah. When we pick the quote for every episode now, and like, how does this relate to Jonathan? And I think he's someone who probably early on just overcame all these aspects of fear that might have been holding, might hold someone back in that, in the entertainment world. Like, you, there'd be a million things that would come up that might cause some type of fear that could get in the way of you accomplishing your goals. And Jonathan's a guy who achieved so much, so he obviously overcame that.
And what he's managed to accomplish in his life, I imagine a lot of people would be terrified to pursue.
Yeah. 100% being in front of that many eyes every week or every episode.
In particular with comedy.
Yeah.
That feels really, really scary. Like, what people find funny even isn't always the same.
Yeah, it's bold to put yourself out there. And
yeah,
he's had great success. So let's jump in and celebrate Mr. Jonathan Torrence, who just a great dude. Invited us into his home and feel very, very lucky to have the opportunity.
And his two dogs, Joy and Happy, are just my soulmates. So we'll give them a shout out too.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks for listening, everyone. How much of that separation do you applies to your work life in acting?
I would say my life is by design very different than my work for a bunch of reasons. One is I like to play characters based on people that I encounter in my everyday life. If my life is going to openings and award shows, you don't really get the well filled up. So I like to live in a real place with real people and have real experiences. And my day-to-day life changed very little during COVID, changes very little now. We walk the dogs, we feed the horses, we go for walks. So I think naturally with my street sense money, when I was a teenager, I bought an apple farm outside of Windsor, Nova Scotia. Mm. And I remember driving down Spring Garden Road, Labor Day weekend, all kinds of beautiful young women arriving in town to go to university. And I'm doing the most antisocial thing I can possibly think of, which is drive an hour away to be by myself in the woods. I think that's always been something that I've needed.
You've made that comment yourself, Mike, with writing in how you like encountering everyday people to inspire your characters.
Well, the
Should
fabric
I, I'm of- so sorry. Should I make Joy go away? Yes.
Depends on how long Joy is.
Not forever. God,
like Joy in general, because we're here for lots of Joy. Jonathan has two dogs, one big, one small. Happy. Joy and Happy.
Very cute.
Very cute.
Our friends now, forever.
Yeah.
Forever.
But yeah, like, anyone who's consuming art that I create is just a person out there in the world, just like I am too. So I want to create things that are relatable. And I have to look at these moments and be an observer and try to take it in so I'm able to relate back something that they can understand. And whether that's going home in the summer to small town Cape Breton and just watching how my town functions and all the people who inspired me growing up and trying to create something that I know they can listen to or they can read and maybe see a little bit of themselves in it. Maybe not exactly, but it's something that they can find those similarities in it. And maybe they're not even recognizing that, but they can appreciate it.
Mm. Have you ever played a character that you've never encountered in real life?
It's a good question. Occasionally I find myself playing a character for which I have no reference. I was on a show called Moonshine a few years ago.
Yeah.
Played a kind of creepy politician guy. No problem.
Yeah.
But he had this sort of arc where he became a tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy theorist. I don't really have a reference point for that. And that's weird turf. We made a show with a comedian named Nathan McIntosh called Trapped. I was playing a character based on a family member of his who is also kind of conspiracy theorist, like way out there, the drones are watching us kind of person. I don't really watch shows about that stuff. I'm not really a sci-fi person. Mm-hmm. So occasionally I find myself rudderless and with no reference point. But I think the characters that have landed the hardest are probably the ones that are grounded in some degree of truth. And people often ask, are they based on anyone? The answer is no, they're kind of based on everyone. Because mm-hmm. I might take a sniffle from one person and a verbal tic from another and kind of mash mm-hmm. them together and just try to make them kind of real.
What do you do when you don't have that reference point?
Say the words and look the other person in the eye and hope.
Acting 101.
It hasn't happened much, to be honest.
Yeah. I have a funny story. My cousin wrote a script for, it was kind of a claymation video a number of years ago, probably 20 years ago. I was in my early 20s, and he wanted me to play a character in it, and it was called The Cape Breton Ghost Story. And he's like, oh, Mike can nail this. So he sent me the script, and I don't know what the hell I'm doing. So I just read my lines, had my lines down, but obviously in acting, it's very important to know what other people are saying so you can react to that. But my first time hearing what the other character said was when I was recording in the studio at CBC. And yeah, it was way harder than I thought, and I was not prepared.
But I did an episode of American Dad years ago, and I haven't done much voice work, despite always kind of wanting to. And that was a really trippy experience because they would say, okay, say your line, and I would say, good morning. And they'd say, no, say it like, good morning. And be
and
like, okay,
say the same,
good morning.
It sounds like the exact same thing.
Good morning. What? Like, I've never felt less like I was nailing what they were going for. But in my head, I like to think of myself as having a pretty decent ear. I was not giving them what they wanted. Mm-hmm. That's a trippy experience. So I figured the workaround for that is to be in a position where you're the boss. So you can at least try to dictate what is what we're looking for.
What about showing up as yourself? And what I mean by this is I did a TV show where they were featuring some of my upholstery that I make as one of my art creations. And they would ask me questions and I would answer and they'd be like, Yeah, but say it like this, like with a lot of life. And I understood, okay, this is television. You want for maybe your guest to appear a certain way. But it was so unnatural to me that I thought, well, am I playing Kristen or am I Kristen? Has that ever happened with you?
I think I was lucky in some ways that I kind of got burnt pretty early, pretty quickly with some of that stuff. I started on Street Sense at 15. Mm. And I remember distinctly a photographer saying, I don't enjoy having my picture taken. I don't smile easily. It's not a comfortable thing for me to do. And I remember him saying, just loosen up, have some fun with it. Like, bleh, like stick your tongue out, jump up in the air, like just go crazy. Mm. So I did something that felt completely unnatural. Of course, that was the picture they used. I cringed when I saw it. So now I just can't. I think people often overlook how important it is to rule out the things you're not good at on the road to figuring out what you are good at. I'm not good at having my picture taken. I had a commercial agent when I lived in LA, and the idea was so I would build up a better ability to audition because I hadn't done it much and I was terrible at it, apologizing midway through, like, I'm sorry, guys, I'm almost done. Sorry for stinking up the room. People are like, what are you doing?
Sorry, I'm Canadian. Sorry.
Exactly. And Americans don't think like that.
Yeah.
They're not apologetic. So I was sabotaging my own auditions because of, I don't know, sheepishness or self-deprecation, East Coast Canada garbage that we're carrying for generations. Yeah.
It was a positive experience in the end to learn exactly what you're describing. This is not how I show up or I'm comfortable showing up or want to be public facing. But having gone through that and having that emotion, it's like, okay, if this happens again, I'm not going to just do this because some guy I just met 10 minutes ago asked me to.
Well, I guess because my whole career, I've gone back and forth between I'm playing a character and now I'm hosting a game show and now I'm playing a different character and now I'm hosting a talk show. My instinct is to always default to a sketch character version of that. If it's a game show, like, good morning, everyone, it's time to play the thing. Like, I kind of find myself being that guy versus actually being that guy. I always say to people, being yourself on television is incredibly hard.
Yeah.
Because suddenly you're aware of your tongue and your eyebrows and what's my face doing right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I do an interview as myself on the subject of J-Rock, for example, people are like, man, it hurts my ears to hear him talk as himself because he's so firmly ingrained in my mind as being that character, which is the ultimate compliment. And I think it also is best to keep a bit of mystery if you're someone that wants to play different characters and be believable as those characters, to not show your whole hand all the time. Mm-hmm.
Did you have aspirations for this career growing up in Charlottetown? What was Jonathan like as a young boy on the island?
Yeah, I don't think it surprised anyone that I ended up doing something like this.
Yeah.
My first play was in grade one, The Rabbit Who Wanted Red Wings. I didn't have the time to make a decision to pursue this line of work. It happened in my teenage years at a time in my life when I was looking for stability anywhere I could find it.
Yeah.
It happened kind of gradually. And next thing I knew, I was sort of on this moving sidewalk that has served me really well for decades now. I wanted to be a stockbroker.
Yeah.
And I had been taking classical guitar lessons since I was eight. So I thought I'd maybe play in bistros on nights and weekends and sort of have both ends of that at play in my life. Yeah, but
this is somewhere in the middle of that, I would say.
I guess. I think in hindsight, the thing that appealed to me about being a stockbroker was the drama of being on the floor and throwing the tickets in the air and people being mad and throwing pens and stuff. So I think it was probably the same muscle, just flexed in a different way.
Yeah. 15's young though. What did you audition for that role? What was getting in the Street Sense like?
I did a musical at St. Pat's High School called Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. One of those, like, we need more guys kind of thing. Same reason I took ballroom dancing for 2 years in junior high. And the producer of Street Sense, show that was in development at the time, came to see the show, called the school the next day and said, would that guy give me a call back? And he said, do you want to audition? And I did. I didn't get it immediately. Another guy got it. But they brought me in to do a story in like the third episode of season one. And then was off to the races.
This feels like one of those dreamy stories that people hope happen to them if they're interested in getting into entertainment. Does this still happen where people are just kind of
recruited? Well, great question. I think probably it happens on TikTok now.
Mm,
maybe
right.
It happened to you guys with your podcast. This was before the internet. There were fewer outlets as far as being able to do it yourself in the comfort of your own home. Like Mike Clattenburg, the guy who created Trailer Park Boys, and I used to make music videos in the early days, and we had to save up enough film till we had enough film to make a music video.
Mm.
And then we had to save up money till we had enough money to pay to expose the film and hope it turned out. Like, you can make a film on your phone this afternoon.
Yeah, while you're on the bus.
Which is awesome and terrible.
Mm.
Do you feel like adapting to these changes is something that you were able to roll with smoothly, or did you just not even think about them and just did what you did?
I've never really been a technical person, yeah. So the technical aspect of directing, for example, doesn't really excite me, probably as much as it should. Mm. I've always liked words and jokes and performances. Again, in terms of being aware of what you're not good at, like helicopter chase, that's not my scene. It's not what I watch. It's not what interests me. But people having a conversation that seems authentic and real, I have a pretty good ear for that stuff. So the technology part didn't ever excite me. I would say the biggest shift I've had to find a way to navigate, and it's really exciting, is I'm a middle-aged white guy at this moment in our history, when the world isn't looking for more middle-aged white guys, long overdue, important conversations are happening, communities are being reflected on television that have never been before, and that's yeah. awesome. So what can I contribute to this conversation? I've been collaborating with and working with people that haven't seen themselves enough on TV, and that feels like I can take the chocolate of experience and reputation and reach and pair it with the peanut butter of people whose stories deserve to be told, and that is really an exciting way to reinvigorate my relationship with my craft.
Mm.
COVID was another one. I had to distill it down to the bare basics. I was taping iPads to trees and shooting things myself
yeah.
and coming up with creative ways to make stuff. And by going back to the very nugget of what interested me in the first place, because I remember the early days of going out on a flight on a street sense story to Winnipeg about illegal curves and hockey sticks and going with blank tapes and coming back with raw footage, like, still gets me fired up. So I fell in love with the work again during COVID by just stripping it right down.
COVID was a period of time that we were forced as creatives to rethink some of our methodology, but do you find, you started at 15, you're now early 50s, I believe.
Yeah.
Do you make a point like every decade, or how do you check in with yourself to say, what is my why? What is my motivation? Like, how are you evolving just personally with growing older and still in this work?
I know. I think I blacked out when you said you're in your early 50s because it still seems inconceivable. I remember having a conversation with my wife's grandfather who is 95, and he said, the thing is, in my head, I'm 15. My body begs to differ, and it's really hard to reconcile those two things. So I like the idea that you feel young your whole life. COVID was interesting because my whole life, from the time I was very young, I was Buddy on TV. I was the guy from that show, or Jonovision, or J-Rock, or whatever. COVID was kind of the first time that I was like, wait, what else am I?
Yeah.
And it was a great reminder. I'm a great dad. I'm a, I think, really good husband. I love animals. I love playing music. I'm generous. I am kind to the people around me. Like, it was, do you remember Stuart Smalley from SNL? Might be before your time, but the guy that looked in the mirror and was like, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a come to Jesus about who am I and what am I doing in the world? And I've come to the conclusion recently, as obvious as it sounds, with time not on my side anymore in the late afternoon of life. Mm. Want to spend more time doing what I love and less time doing what I don't.
I know, Mike, you're going through just a bit of this reflection, we'll say, at this point in your career. And when you started out as 20 is different than where we found ourselves now. So how do you kind of check in with yourself?
Well, I think it's exactly what Jonathan's saying there, asking those questions and the why behind it. And when I first started playing music, I don't think I had a question, anything. It was just so obvious what I was doing and why I was doing it. And then because we're going to be the biggest band to ever play on planet Earth, right? That was the goal.
And you did that.
Yes. And once you accomplish that, you try then to what? Figure out what the hell is next. But yeah, I think I just turned 41, and my ideas of what a musician is at this age is very different than what I had in the beginning. And yeah, I like being home more. I don't want to go play in London, Ontario for three people on a Tuesday. I don't want to go anywhere where I have to really grind things, you know, to make it come to life. So it's going towards the opportunities that make sense. And that meant playing less shows, traveling less, but being more in the studio, focusing on working on songs and writing songs. And just, we've said this in the podcast multiple times before, following the breadcrumbs, like where are they leading you? And for me, the path is slightly different, but still, I'm a musician trying to make a go at things, the same as I was when I was 19 and started this. But yeah, I think it for me lately, I had a kind of just question, do I want to do a cross Canada tour? And I do if I can sleep in a comfortable bed every night and I can get paid every night, but I don't want to just go out and like I did when I was 19 and just, yeah, whatever happens, happens. It's going to all be for the best in the end. Mm. So I think it's just a combination of age and just recognizing where I am at this point in my life. And ultimately it's, they're both fine, whether you want to take over the world or you want to just work on songs in your bedroom and get another job. I think it's all fine in the end. That's not what I want to do. I still want to sort of take over the world, maybe not with the same gusto that I had when I was...
But from home.
Yeah.
In pajamas.
I had two moments in the last couple of years that blew my mind and rewired how I think.
Yeah.
My wife has a clothing store in Bedford.
Yeah.
And it's doing well.
Say the name. Let's get some promo
Sugar
going.
Daisy Boutique, named after one kid.
Yeah.
And she has a shoe store called Indy's Shoeteque. Mm. Our other daughter's name is Indigo. Turns out there was another chain of stores with the same name. So the natural inclination when you think that way, as you do in your 20s with piss and vinegar and I'm going to take over the world, is to where can I open another store? Maybe by the end of the year, should we open four stores?
Yeah.
And it's a natural... reasonable risk. And Carol, who is very wise, was like, I'm good.
Like, yeah.
What? She's like, it's working. I'm satisfied.
Yeah.
I have good balance in my life. I'm home. I can pick the girls up from school and make dinner and I buy things for the store during the day and I'm satisfied.
Like, I have so much respect for people that are able to just find that peace within their life.
That.
Like you don't have to be on the hamster wheel forever.
Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And the other one was we were in Lisbon taking a cab to the airport and the cab driver had been up early. He went surfing. He was driving for a few hours and then he's going to meet some friends for dinner in the town square. And he was probably 34. I was like, man, you have life figured out, don't you? And he said, the problem with you people, and I think he meant North Americans, is that you want.
Mm-hmm.
I just want enough. Like, oh my God, enough. Mm-hmm. Right. All of the time I spend, you know, renewing an insurance policy for a set of flats that we hoped would go up in value, like the admin of life can really be a time suck. And it's true. You don't need much. You just need enough. So that is the mindset that I'm adopting.
Is it all priorities and just going towards what would make sense?
Well, I kind of feel like I'm sure people that work in my business think, why would you live in Truro? It's not exactly a hotbed of production. That is true. But I'm not trying to get 5 lines on a CTV drama of the week. Like, I'm not a busy working actor. I'm not really a good enough actor to be in the grind in that way. Plus, that would require living in Toronto, which I don't really choose to do.
Yeah.
I always say I went to LA to make It without really knowing what my It was. And I've been reading John Stamos's autobiography. Yeah. Indigo gave it to me for Christmas. And Carol read Matthew Perry's autobiography. They both had this thirst for fame.
Mm.
Don't care what it is, at all costs, I'm going to be famous. I never had that. And I think to ride it out and sleep on friends' couches and sleep in bed bug infested beds crossing the country, you need that thirst for fame. Because otherwise, how would you stick it out through those awful Tuesday nights at Crocodile Charlie's?
Yeah,
in
exactly.
Sudbury, playing two guys in suits going, can you turn it down?
Yeah. I've done that many times.
Exactly.
Yeah. He was one of the two people, maybe, described it so eloquently.
So I kind of feel like living here, I have it figured out. I get to write some jokes, shovel some horse shit, pick the girls up from school, go for a walk with my wife. I feel like I can achieve everything I want in the world right here. We live in the quiet. We visit the noise. And I've discovered the power of the word no, which took me a long time. And as a freelancer and a creative, no, you feel like, oh my God, the phone's never going to ring again if I say no to this.
Yeah.
It's just instinct, like counterintuitive to say no. But it often puts the other people in a position where they're like, well, what would it take to make it a yes? More money, better working conditions? Like, let's talk about it. Or the worst case scenario is you turn down a gig and then you have that time. And at my age and stage, time is the only currency I really care about because it increases in speed.
Mm. And I feel like we can do so much more from home now with the technology we have. And rather than going and playing this Sudbury Tuesday night, we can work on something online, a video that might reach 5,000 people. And if ultimately we're just looking to gain listeners or grow our audience, like, is it more worthwhile to just put a day's work into creating some type of online content than the travel, the gas, the paying the session musicians and all that? Than just, creating something you can put out to the world anyway. So I
was saying this to a friend yesterday. We can, in this part of the world, we can catch 1,000 mackerel while people are waiting to land a tuna.
Yeah.
Right? It's when I'm making a show in Truro, I know that it takes 6 minutes to get across town unless you get the red light. I know no one's going to ask you for a shooting permit. I know people will probably say, you want to shoot in my convenience store? Great. What's that going to cost me?
Yeah.
Like, no, we would pay you to use your space. Yeah. It's a novelty. It's a treat. People are happy to see you.
Yeah.
The work is often hard enough and the hours are long enough that you might as well make the circumstances favorable. And there are a couple ways to do that. One, do it in a place you love. And two, do it with people that you love.
Was there ever a time in your life that you wished you had that thirst?
Did you want to be on Full House?
Wasn't like Full Jesse. House. There was a brief, like, all the shows that you might expect at the time I was there, I was in the mix on. I read for, what was the Joel McHale show? The Soup on E. Like, all those, like, a guy in a suit shows. It was down to me and one other guy for a nightly talk show on CNN. That was pretty wild. He was political. I was funny. They couldn't decide which way they wanted to go. And then the network executive got fired. But I got to do an audition sitting in Larry King's chair on Larry King's set. Like, some little moments when I look back now think, that was pretty cool. But I remember talking to Rick Mercer years ago and saying, why don't you do a talk show? Like, if ever there was someone in Canada that should do a nightly talk show, like, you're pre-approved like a mortgage. People love you. And he's like, I don't want to work that hard.
Yeah.
Like, right. Yes. he works really hard on putting a half hour together every week, has a nice life. People are happy to see him, but he hasn't overstayed his welcome. I think that's kind of been a philosophy I've carried, trying to leave shows before the audience does.
Hi, friends of Mike and Kristen. My name is Nancy Regan, and it's a pleasure and privilege to be a sponsor of this podcast because I love the way these two creators show up. I spent a big chunk of my life on TV, projecting an air of confidence to an audience of more than 250,000 people. The spotlight lit me up, but the truth is, for most of that time, I didn't feel my own light. I was wearing a social mask to show the world I had it all together, even when I felt close to falling apart. The fear of failure haunted me because I didn't want anyone to know the secret I harbored, that I was not enough. Not smart enough, not talented enough, just not enough. The good news is I've left that lens behind. I traded in my inner imposter for a life of liberating authenticity. It hasn't been an easy path, but man, is it worth it. I share my story with a whopping dose of vulnerability in my book, From Showing Off to Showing Up. As I see it, showing off is living a life according to the expectations of others, craving approval. Showing up is, here I am, take me or leave me. And the beautiful, gratifying, and deeply comforting result is that I've heard from hundreds of readers who say they see themselves in my story. If something about this resonates with you, come along for the journey. From Showing Off to Showing Up is available in paperback, ebook, and now audiobook, read by me, of course. I promise I'll show up. Will you?
Was there ever a point where you felt like you were doing too much and you weren't giving the attention to the things that mattered to you?
That's a terrible feeling.
Yeah.
And learning the word no helped with that. 'Cause I think there was a time when I was doing TV with TV's Jonathan Torrens and hosting Wipeout Canada. I might have still been on Trailer Park Boys at the same time.
Yeah.
And just philosophically, I would never want someone to say like, Jesus, is there anyone else? Or save some jobs for the rest of us or like that stuff. I would always rather be like J-Rock was garnish. He's not the main dish. Mm. And I would always rather be the character that people are like, man, when's he going to be on again?
Yeah.
Instead of the enough already guy. There was another time when I was working on Trailer Park and working on a show for the Travel Channel called The Kids Are in Charge, Travel Channel in the States. And I went back and forth from Honolulu to Halifax 3 times in 2 weeks.
Jesus.
I was so tired. I was watching Nacho Libre for the 3rd time and didn't remember I'd seen it before. Like just stunned, sitting, staring at the screen ahead of me. Like that's not fun busy.
Yeah.
That's just... I suppose it sounds glamorous hearing it out loud, but I don't ever need to be that busy again. My father-in-law said, instead of doing 10 things half-assed, why don't you pick 2 and go hard at them?
Yeah.
Like, right.
Yeah.
So smart. Because I can get my head swiveled around by shiny things like a motel in Bedeck. I want to work at a motel in Bedeck. And he's like, do you want to be behind the counter when Tina and Doug's flight from Winnipeg is delayed and you need to give them a set of keys at 11:30 p.m.? Like, no, I don't. Yourself a job. That's what he calls that.
How did you come to terms with saying no and accept that maybe you will lose this opportunity, that it's okay to say no? Because I'm in this place where I feel like I have to take on all these things to get to the next thing. And then I'll have too much on my plate. I'm like, oh, I'm doing too many things and doing exactly that. I need to take on 2 things and do them all out and the 10 half-assed.
Here's what doesn't jive. Establishing your worth, both in business and in the world, in relationships, both business and personal, and being from this part of the country. Because it's baked into us that we don't deserve things or we feel like we're showing off to say this is what it costs.
Yes.
But the truth is, it's confidence instilling to me if I'm hiring someone for their services and they say, this is what it costs, but this is what you get. Perfect.
Yeah.
I can choose not to pay it, but I can't tell you what you're worth. You determine that.
Yeah.
So I would not underestimate the power of saying, this is my rate.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause people are like, oh, well, if he's that convicted in it, it must be worth paying. But it's real easy to spread yourself thin. And I have three criteria: fun, money, challenge. And any gig that I do has to have two of them. And the fun challenge ones are often a role I've never played before, a place I've never been before, helping out a friend. But anytime I've done something for just one, it's sucked.
Mm.
So that mechanism has never steered me wrong.
That's a great formula to live by. Mm. Yeah.
Like yeah. You it. Have to do like a combo is great. 'Cause if you did all fun money ones, then you're not challenging yourself. Mm. Yeah.
I love that you've raised the culture of Nova Scotia. It's something that we're proud of. We're certainly proud to call Nova Scotia home and have had the benefit to travel other parts of the world. And people recognize in us that we're different. And you don't realize that about yourself until someone points it out in you, or that you are amongst others. And I know we were in Colombia a couple of years ago and people would say, "You're so Canadian. You're so Canadian." And we thought, well, what does that mean? And they said, you look Canadian, you act Canadian, the things that you say. And they actually asked us if it was exhausting being that nice. And I just wondered, like, you talked about being apologizing in when you were working in the States auditioning, and how much have you encountered this identity of being from Nova Scotia and people recognizing that in you?
Well, I was under the impression, I think because of Jim Carrey and Mike Myers, that there was sort of an open door policy for Canadians that work in comedy. So I think I thought when I got to LA, people would be like, thank God you're here. We've been expecting you. I had a pretty banging demo reel by the time I went down there, as you might expect, with all the characters I played on Street Sense and Jonavision. There is there are a couple of misconceptions about LA in my business specifically. One is it's Canada's third largest city. There are more Canadians there than Calgary. Two is there's a reluctance to accept anything you've done outside the 310 area code. So it didn't matter what was on my reel. Have I done it here? Which I didn't expect. And the third thing is people don't really care. We grow up here with this misconception that Americans are rude because they can't name all the provinces. They are very friendly. They're just direct, and we're not used to communicating like that. They are, if you're standing in front of the door, they'll say, move.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right. Whereas we would say, sorry, if you have a sec, I wouldn't mind scooching past you. Like, already
stand
spent 10
there
seconds,
for 18 minutes until they were ready.
Clear. Yeah. So I was reminded of that just being in the States now. I apologized for something that was not my fault, and the American person I was working with said, you're fine. Which was like, you're giving me a gift by saying it's okay that I felt bad or that I apologized. Mm-hmm. Like, we just communicate differently. So the big one was we equate self-confidence and arrogance and think they're the same. And in the States, if you are not self-confident, you're not going to get any traction whatsoever. And really, by dictionary definition, self-confidence is not a bad thing to have.
Yeah.
And especially when you're a salesperson and the product you're selling is yourselves, if you're not buying or believing in your own product, no one's going to buy it.
This is something I really struggle with owning a business, is the balance of self-promotion, which we're almost taught, you should be self-confident. Like, this is an aspirational place for you to arrive. But once you arrive there, there's also this feeling of others are judging me because I'm not supposed to actually be confident in public. And this is a real weird space to live in running a business, because you want to celebrate your wins or be promoting your product. But you're also very self-aware that we live in a place that really doesn't go over well all the time. So how do you manage that part of your life?
Can I say something to you?
Of course.
That's really cool what you did, quitting your job and opening this space and starting this podcast.
Thanks. Thank you.
Does it feel weird to take a compliment without diminishing it or deflecting it or cheapening it or paying it back?
It's only a church gallery, you know?
Yeah,
exactly. Oh, no, it's a space that's going to be torn down.
Yeah.
It's so baked into our DNA, the shrugging it off and avoiding eye contact. And taking a compliment is a huge personal development goal. And it's something that I still struggle with too, but they feel nice.
They feel nice, but it's also a place that I'm putting effort into arriving at. So for you to say that to me, probably you're right, Mike. I would have a year ago maybe even deflected that and said, oh, it's just that this is just that. But I'm putting effort into receiving that and that being okay and being comfortable.
Did it feel good?
That's the goal. It did feel good. And it also feels good. Like this is a moment for me. Like I'm sitting across from someone who in my life is a cultural icon. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm going to turn the tables and compliment you and we can be blushing together. But there were things about street sense in particular that just became our vernacular in high school. So you might remember in the intro of your show, there's a woman, I hope she's not listening, but she goes, don't even go there, Angela.
Yeah.
And so that became just jargon we would use where if somebody came up and they were like kind of teasing you, you'd turn around and be like, don't even go there, Angela. And that was just like a phrase that we used, a catchphrase.
That was the first promo from JonoVision.
Yeah.
And this was, I left Street Sense to do my own talk show. There were sketches and it was a battle of the band sometimes. And it changed every day depending on what the audience was and what we were able to kind of get away with. Great thing about working in children's TV is no one was really paying attention. Mm. But what we didn't anticipate is that all of the guests on our show were defaulting to Ricky Lake and Montel and all the talk show references that they had in their mind. So Angela and her sister came on the show bickering about something like, my sister borrowed my pants and never gave them back next time on JonoVision. Mm. So our first episode out of the gate, these people are playing caricatures of what they think talk show guests are to try to make it sound dramatic and stuff. And that's how it ended up in the promo. But don't even go there, Angela, is a phrase that I am very familiar with because it was like, no, that's not what we meant.
That's not, and I apologize. That was in JonoVision. I said Street Sense. But just to say,
it's all the same era.
Yeah, this became just part of our kind of joking around. And you were the face and the voice and represented all of that to us. So it's also kind of a full circle, surreal moment to be sitting in your home and hanging out with your dogs and just having a very common chat. Yeah. Yeah. It's really special.
I think part of the thing with aging has been I've been on the receiving end of more of these kind of compliments or just want you to know we didn't have cable. We watched your show growing up or like people that work in this business now that are coming up are like, I've known you my whole life. And that feels really nice. And people are very excited to tell me that. And it's my job to listen and say thank you and let it wash over me. That's a really, in a time when there are so many hard conversations, that's a really nice conversation to have, right?
Mm. I'm curious, since most of what you do is is comedy based, your characters, the shows you've been on. Did you ever do any stand-up yourself?
I did it once to impress a girl at a bar in Toronto. It was one of those like, there's supposed to be 10 people on the bill. One person didn't show up. The manager said, would you like to go up? Incidentally, Mark Forward, whose name you might know, terrific stand-up, who was on Mr. D and Letterkenny as coach, was the bartender there that night. So he's one of the only witnesses to my stand-up career in its entirety. It was one of those like everyone's doing 8 minutes. I didn't know what the red light at the back of the room meant. I think I did 12. Turns out that's gauche. Never done it again because there's a prime example of I have so much respect for the craft, but in my experience with my sketch background, I kind of defaulted to a hey, what else can I tell you guys? Like didn't have an act.
Yeah.
But I was kind of doing a caricature of a stand-up guy. That's a hard row to hoe. Mm. Hard to find an original voice in stand-up comedy, that's for sure.
And the work you have to put in is you're on stage 5 nights a week. You're constantly editing your material, finding out what the best way to say it is and shifting words slightly. And
yeah,
it seems like everyone who's become good at it has to just put in so much time. You have to...
I think Chris Rock said you have to know you're going to suck 1,000 times.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't deter you, I just read Brent Butt's book, which was not at all comedic. It was about comedians on the road, but it was quite violent and gory, as a matter of fact.
Really?
But he was talking a lot about specific things that stand-ups have to do, specificity and hard consonants and things like that. Like, instead of back of a car, trunk of your grandpa's Buick. Like, oh yeah, that is way funnier because it's so specific.
Mm.
So there are a lot of written and unwritten rules to stand-up comedy, but in a way, comedy is all the same, but in a way, there are very different dialects. I'm a good improviser. I'm an okay sitcom actor. Yeah, I think improv is probably my favorite of the arenas. Yeah.
Did you impress the girl that night with your 12-minute comedy set?
She was still at the table when I got back.
That's a good,
into that
that's
what
a good
you
start.
Will. Yeah.
Where did you meet your now wife, Carol?
There's a guy named Mike Tompkins, who's a photographer in film and TV, and he's from Truro, started Pizza Farm here years ago. So Carol knew him growing up. I was in LA, kind of got disenchanted with the whole process of being there. Was going to all these commercial auditions that I didn't care about the outcome. It was violent. I lived in Venice, and by the beach was beautiful, but there are gangs there, and it's America. And a couple of times I was escorted to my door from my car by a cop with his weapon out. Like, there's someone in the neighborhood. We're just kind of taking precautions, like real American stuff. So it got to the point where there was no job that would be better than being here. Because going there is cool. I came back and forth a lot. Then you're filing taxes in two countries. I come home for a week a year. Should I have a car here? Should I rent a car every time? Like, just the duality of it becomes a bit of a drag. It's easier to just commit to either place. So I was ready to commit back here. Renovated a house. Wasn't sure what I was going to do. My manager from there kept calling saying you need new headshots. Hate having my picture taken, as I mentioned. So we were renovating this house on Church Street in Halifax. And at the end of the year, Mike, the photographer, said, let's take some headshots in this space that we've finished. My friend Carol just took a makeup class, and I opened the door, and there she was. And I thought, there you are.
Mm.
And she would tell the story the same, I expect.
She would not. it was the least cool I've ever been about anything. It was the most acting I've ever done, trying to pretend I was disinterested. I would make little deals with myself. She would send an email. Okay, you can walk around the block five times and then email her back. But you can't pounce on it. Like, try to be even the slightest bit cool. And I just couldn't. She's wonderful.
I've only heard you speak very highly of her in a complimentary way. You seem to have a true love story, and you live in this beautiful home now. You have two girls. What's life like as a dad? How have your interests and passions changed?
Great question. We live here because Carol is from this community outside of Truro. Her folks live less than a kilometer away. My kids get to see their grandparents most days, which is not something I ever got to experience. That's really cool. For my work, if I have to travel, it's 40 minutes to the airport. It's a head start to the States, whatever. But mostly the fact that she was willing to live with me, I didn't care where that was. but we built our dream house on this piece of land that we were lucky enough to buy from a farmer in the community. And deep roots is not really something I ever had. My dad was from England, and he was kind of ended up in PEI. He passed away when I was pretty young. My mother's family was from New Glasgow. We didn't really ever have a place there or anything. So the concept of roots and history and being a part of something that will be, continue to be here after you're gone is not something I've ever experienced. And it's pretty cool. I like that the novelty of me living here is worn off. Right? People see me at Sobeys every day. So what I do for a living is a very, very small part of my existence here, just the way I like it. Our girls are grounded and kind. Carol's been very selfless and dedicated and invested a lot of time in them. She's excellent at being present, which I think is something that a lot of people struggle with nowadays. And she's not on social media. She has had to get on Instagram for her business, but she's mm-hmm. like, I don't understand. I put a picture of a shirt and I say, LOL. Like, why am I, why?
Yeah.
And she's right. Why?
Yeah.
She's right. But it's also like the equivalent of putting a flyer in someone's mailbox nowadays. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of the way the world works. But I remember early on when I think Sugar Daisy was a year and a half or something, I was talking about how great it is that I can work from home, but I'm also like here and I'm helping. And she was like, gonna stop you there. You're probably not doing either to the best of your ability. We know you have to work. People work, go work. But when you're here, be here. Mm-hmm. And she's so right. And that is, I think, for everyone, especially in art land or freelance world, when does your workday end and when does your life start?
Yeah.
During the pandemic, I bought a shed at Old Hickory Sheds. So I have a 20-foot walk to work. And even that as a sorbet for like, now I'm finished working. Now I'm just dad in the house. That's helped a lot.
We find that with traveling, that being in a different environment is one of the few places where we feel we can actually just exhale. Because being working from home and even in the gallery, you just can't help but have that association with that physical space. So yeah, being 20 feet away, or in our case, it's usually a couple thousand kilometers to achieve that, so be it. But being aware of that separation, I suppose, is the first step.
When we found camping is terrific. If you told me 10 years ago that I would enjoy camping, I might have taken umbrage with it. But if we're here, one of us will be doing the dishes or feeling the pressure to go mow, or I should go muck the stalls or something. But camping, there's nothing to do but sit by the fire. So all of us, all four of us, are very content when we're on the road on a camping trip.
Do you have favorite spots on the East Coast?
Yeah, East Coast of Massachusetts.
Oh.
There's a place called Normandy Farms, which is close enough to Boston if you want to take in a Sox game or something.
Yeah.
We've gone there a fair bit. It's a bit of a weird one given my job, because if we were going on a flight to an all-inclusive and there's a few like friggin' J-Rock in the departures lounge, you're like, might be a long week.
Yeah.
Don't mean to sound ungrateful, but if you really want to, like, speaking of being yourself somewhere, you don't want to feel like you're performing on vacation for the week. Yeah. So we found that going to the States is great for that. But also because I'm from PEI, Marco Polo Land is a place that we've gone a fair bit too.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about this, about being recognized, how that might feel in public, being with your family. And you mentioned playing a role on Moonshine. This last summer, we had Jennifer Finnegan and her husband, Johnny, come to the gallery for a show. And I don't know, we were setting up, like all these people were arriving. So you're kind of distracted and you know that you're hosting. So you're thinking about sound, and it was 800 degrees in there. And how am I going to deal with this? And I just kind of caught out of the corner of my eye this beautiful couple. I didn't know who they were, but they were almost like glowworms in the parking lot. Like, just shiny, pretty people are coming in. So, and really it was more Jen that I was like, whoa, she is a beautiful woman. And they came in and just enjoyed the show. And Mike and I went over and said hello during intermission, like we did to everybody in the room that night. And we've since become friends with them, and really, I think we're aware of their connection to Nova Scotia and how they found ease being here. So I'm sure they were recognized constantly in Hubbard's, where you were filming Moonshine, but we've always tried to be mindful of that in interacting with them or other, you know, quote, celebrities who might be just receiving that constant attention and energy. It's a hard thing maybe for you to talk about, because I know that it's part of your job. You appreciate and need fans, But how does that almost, I don't know, I imagine it may even erode at your sense of self or sense of presence because you're constantly balancing people that might recognize you, everything from getting groceries to being in the airport to, yeah.
I think it's important to distinguish between fame and Canadian fame because it is different.
Okay.
There are probably a handful of people realistically, and this isn't being self-deprecating, realistically, there are a handful of people that became huge stars in our country, staying in our country. So take the Jim Carrey's and Mike Myers's and Celine's off the table. Mm-hmm. You have your Rick Mercer's, Peter Mansbridge, Ron McLean, Mr. Dress Up, Gordon Pinsent. Mm-hmm. That's probably it. Like Sandy Rinaldo, like some kind of news figures that people see a lot. My approach has always been, if you take half an hour a week to watch the show, I can take 10 seconds to say thank you. We were talking a little bit before we started rolling about how the interaction has changed, because it used to be I would get something from it. My cousin was on Street Sense, or I did a What's Your Beef one time, or I was in the audience for Jonovision when I was in grade 11. Cool. Tell me about that. What was the episode? Where did you come from? What was your school? Now it's mostly about the selfie,
yeah,
which is a weird exchange for a couple of reasons, because if I'm coming out of Canadian Tire and it's dark and you're like, hey, are you that guy? Can I grab a selfie? And it's a low angle picture and it's maybe not super flattering. And that goes out on the internet. Mm. You're exposing yourself to people being like, whoa, he looks like a half chewed caramel. Like, what is going on? Or you say, honestly, now's not a great time. And then people are like, you know, who's it?
He's an asshole. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say you start from a dick deficit, and to get to he's okay requires a certain amount of effort. I think with age comes the freedom of, as John Stamos said in his autobiography that I was reading last night, quit trying to charm the world. That's very freeing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does it matter to me if people on the internet are like, whoa, buddy's let himself go, or I hated him on Mr. D? Doesn't really bust my flow. Still live in this house. I love the people that I live with. Still never get tired of this view. So caring less helps a lot. And recognizing that it's just part of the job that I love so much also helps a lot. But I'm not surprised that the Jennifer Finnegans of the world, who she lives in LA, that's very much a part of life there. It's very much not a part of life here. But what I always say to people is, you're either a friend or a fan. And once you cross the line, you can't undo that.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
And I'm looking for friends. I'm not out here looking for fans.
Well, we're happy that you said yes to having us in your home today.
My friends.
That's for sure. Like to be friends. Can we be friends? Are we friends now?
I feel like we're friends.
Like, this is on the record.
You
so
should
just,
know.
Careful.
You're on a very short list of people that have been here. Mm. We're both very private. And when we were building our house, the contractor said, where do you want the doorbell? And we were like, that decreases our chances of pretending we're not home significantly. No doorbell. Mm. We hide in the basement.
No, like, windows here.
Yeah, there's headlights on the road. Kids, get to
we're
the basement.
We're in a vault, everyone.
Big time. So we are very much content with our own company most of the time. Carol's folks come over all the time, but our circle is very small.
I heard someone in a business course I'm taking describe their approach to friendship as, I'd rather have four quarters than 100 pennies.
I love that. I
thought that was a good way of thinking about...
I do too. And I've never been, eight couples are going to Cancun. That's not my scene at all. My work is very social. My life isn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to ask you what Nova Scotia means to you.
My answer's probably changed since I had kids.
Yeah.
Cause I would always identify as an islander. As I'm sure you probably would too. You're from Cape Breton first, and then you're from Nova Scotia, whatever the most recent chapter has been.
Yeah.
I'm from PEI, but my home is Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
And I probably would have said until the girls were born, I'm from PEI and that's my home too. We have a place over there now, and that has been very grounding and was something that Carol said, I think this is really important to you, so we should do it. So the idea of that is meaningful. But now it's a place where my kids are from and where we raised them and where they've created all their core memories. Mm. Yeah, so it's home.
Do you see in your girls where they might imagine their future taking them? Have you influenced them as parents, be it in your work or personal life?
We spend much of our time begging them to never leave us. Yeah. They're a real good hang. Neither of us was. Neither was have to have kids people. We're kind of, if it happens, we'll find a way to get behind it. But we weren't family by this age, have mm-hmm. to have kids at all. It has been a real unexpected delight, because they, as much as you think you can shape and mold them, they kind of arrive here pre-wired, and you have, remember a friend saying early on, your voice gets quieter in their head as the years go by, as coaches, partners, friends, bosses, voices get louder. So you have a limited time after they're conscious and before they don't listen to you anymore, where you're like, okay, right, this is Tom Petty. These were the Beatles. Mm-hmm. You should know also that the Rolling Stones, and did you know that the Beach Boys actually influenced the Beatles more than you might expect? Like, you need to download them on everything that you know. But then they also teach you things. Didn't see that coming. They are each part of each of us and their own person entirely. Didn't see that coming. So we beg them to never leave us. Indigo's more of a homebody. Sugar Daisy, we are bracing for, we'll travel far and wide and hopefully come home now and then.
What in 2024 is fit for the pit?
Trump.
Okay.
Like that, it's, as I mentioned, we just got back from a 2-week rip down to the States, and it's becoming less possible and more probable with each passing day. And that feels like one of the biggest ruses of modern times, how certain communities and people that live close to the bone have decided that he reflects their desires and experience in any way and wants the best for them. I just find so inconceivable.
The ones who get taken advantage of the most are the ones who are supporting him.
Yeah. Yeah. But you hear that language like, I want to drain the swamp. And they're like, right, I want to drain the swamp. Mm. Like just resonating on the most kind of base level, or it's time for a change. Yeah, it is time for a change. But the weird thing is, and I'm not one to be able to speak from experience on these matters. And we run into this sometimes. On our podcast, we talk about Canadianity. Mm-hmm. And in our specific context, we're talking about, remember that commercial for Canadian Tire in 1987? But we have to be very careful that we're not suggesting in any way Canada was better then, or it's less good now. Like the values that we love about this country are not ones that don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
As the face of the country is changing, and as there's more of an international population, that is awesome. But it's the same in the States. It's so thinly veiled, the hate and the root of it and where it's coming from. And I wrestle with that on social media, as maybe you guys do too, about opening yourself up to being attacked by a group of people that you don't have the energy or bandwidth to take on. That's fit for the pit.
Mm-hmm. Do you watch the news?
Yeah, less so these days. Less so these days for a myriad of reasons. Mostly we all hang out in the central hub in our house. And, you know, enough bad things happen in the world. And we're trying to, you know, manage what they are exposed to as much as possible. Yeah. So if CNN's blasting 23 hours a day, that's probably not great. So we try to put the devices down and have conversations, you know?
Well, we know that you're a busy guy here and we don't want to keep you, but I do have a couple final questions. What's your favorite kind of chips?
I was hoping this question would come up. Do you want to see the chip cupboard?
Yes.
Yes.
Do you guys have a chip cupboard?
So when Mike and I first met, I had a cereal cupboard and would have probably 8 or 9 kinds of cereal and mix them all together. But okay. this looks quite similar.
This was
in chip form.
One of the ways that Carol blew my mind early on too. I was trying to decide between 2 forms of cereal and she was like, mix them together.
Oh, mix 8 together.
I had never considered that before. So I've married into a family where there's like, let's put some chips in a bowl and then fire some glossettes on top. Yes. Like, you can do that.
Carol knows what's up.
Yeah.
It seems like you're a Lay's guy, though, just by a quick look into the cupboard.
So my mother-in-law brings 3 varieties, a Neapolitan of chips.
Yes.
On Friday nights.
Yeah.
Plain for my father-in-law, salt and Vinny's for me.
Yeah.
And all the ladies like sour cream and onion.
Yeah.
I'm also a Covered Bridge guy.
Okay.
Had a good ongoing relationship with Covered Bridge over the years.
East Coasters.
Yeah. Not partial to Miss Vicky. Okay. What do you do for chips?
I like Old Dutch. I feel like there's a little bit more flavor on Old Dutch brands than Lay's.
What flavor?
Roast chicken's my number one. Like I have the Nova Scotia, maybe world record for eating a big bag of chips in a short amount of time.
Is this a record you made up or an actual record?
Well, I don't know the actual time, but I know it took from the Vans convenience store to the dump, which is probably less than a 2-minute drive.
I love a dump run.
Yeah.
Do you know, speaking of Cape Breton and the dump, this is one of my favorite stories of all time. Bette McDonald.
Yeah.
Her husband, Maynard Morrison.
Yeah.
Comic legend.
Maynard's son was on the podcast 2 weeks ago.
Right.
Mike. Yeah.
From musician. Rock Ranger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. So I don't know if it must have been Mike when he was little. Maynard would say, you can't swear ever unless we're driving down the dump road. Yeah. Then you can roll the window down, let her fly. Which is maybe one of the best images and best short films never made that I've ever heard in my life. I just love that selective parenting because that's so fun for the parents too.
When Kristen first got into politics and was working for the Nova Scotia government, there was this, everyone seems to have one issue that they would come to her with. Like, oh, you have to make sure they cut down on pollution, whatever it was. But
everyone being the general public, recognizing I had any influence whatsoever.
But, Kristen's working with the government now. She can make changes. But so we went home for Christmas and this law had just passed in Nova Scotia where you can't go into the dump and take things out anymore. And so we went home to my father first and his first thing said, Chris, what the hell is this goddamn deal? You can't take stuff out of the dump anymore. What am I supposed to do? So she's like, oh, yeah, I'll see what I can do.
I love that had to become a law because it was becoming an issue. I always think about that with signs that are posted places.
But then we went to the valley to see her father, and his one issue was the exact same thing. You can't go into the dump anymore.
What is this dump nonsense?
This is bullshit.
Like the signs that say, please move your car from the gas pump before you go into Tim Hortons. Like how many times did that have to happen before they had signs made? Someone designed it, picked a font.
And really speaks to the upbringing that we had, that both of our parents' primary concerns were not being able to go to the dump anymore. Yeah.
What is this garbage?
Yeah.
I love the idea of the government, though, like the uppercase G. I remember my mom saying towards the end of her life, they keep showing mice on TV. I'm going to call them and tell them to quit showing mice on there. Like, who is it you're calling?
That's elusive person.
The person in charge of the TV. I'm going to call them and tell them.
Yeah.
No more mice.
That's you now, right?
That's me, yeah. I am the TV.
And just one last question. Who's the best hockey player of all time?
I know you're looking for a instant answer, but I need to know more aspects of the question, like two-way player in points.
Your definition.
Well, I think it has to be Wayne Gretzky.
Yeah.
Because I'm an Oilers fan. That was my era. And I saw him play at the Rick Vive Golf Classic in PEI when I was a kid. And he shot a I don't know, 8-iron from 173 yards out, and it bounced twice and went in the cup.
Yeah.
Like, already thought he was the Lamb of God, yeah, and then he performed that miracle in front of our very eyes.
Have you heard?
But Sid's a close second.
He's been on some podcasts lately, Gretzky has, and he seems like the best guy in the world.
Also, really underrated storyteller.
He's got some story
bangers.
For everything, no matter what you mention. Story, story, yeah, story. And all good ones.
So, yeah. He's had a few years to polish those turds sitting in bars and stuff. But yeah.
Well, we should have him on the podcast, I guess.
We should. Yeah. Manifest it.
We all should. Yeah.
99, well, you're coming.
Yeah, we're coming for
you. Have you tried his whiskey?
Yes.
On our... maybe a year ago, we were at 99th ranking with our podcast and for terrific. Arts podcast, whatever it was. And friends of ours bought us this to in celebration. Yeah. So it's that's why podcast. We had it. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So,
but we appreciate you inviting us here so much. You're a legend, obviously, but most importantly, you're just a great guy who gives back to the community in so many ways. And it truly is an honor to be in your space and your presence. So, thanks so much us.
Thank you.
I am stingy with my time, so thank you for accepting the invite. Because going to you guys is, you know, 2/3 of a day.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to give my time the same critical thought that I give spending money.
It's the most important thing, right?
Amen.
Amen. Most important resource. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Cheers, everyone. Woo.
Another exciting episode.
Mr. Jonathan Torrance.
Nailed it, of course.
Yeah, great dude.
Yeah, it was a really fun afternoon up visiting him. He's got a beautiful home that we were so lucky to visit, and he sent us home with some rolls.
And some Mass Town Market rolls.
Yeah, pretty much everything from there is delicious.
Yeah, and this delicious whiskey, Keeper's Whiskey, which is a company he's involved in.
We told him the story that on the label of the whiskey bottle, it says Stillwater Lake on it, which is the name of our community. And for our podcast party last year, we bought a bottle of that whiskey because of that part of the name, not knowing that he was involved in that project.
Goes down smooth. Try it out, folks.
Yeah, go grab yourself a bottle of Wednesday whiskey. Maybe that'll be our next segment.
And whiskey and rolls.
There you go.
Butter. Butter on the rolls, little whiskey. That's a pretty fun day.
Let's go.
Okay. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Much love from us, and hope you're doing awesome out there. And we'll talk soon. Cheers.